Williams, Ashley M., 1st Baroness Vermeier. Retired from Royal Seleucian Marine Corps after Battle of Horizon, 2334, as Sergeant Major, RSMC. Member of Parliament for Salu II, 2338 to 2372. Minister for War in the Katenra government, 2345 to 2358. Prime Minister, 2358 to 2372. 3 terms Federation Senator for Seleucia, 2372 to 2384. Censured for punching corporate sector Senator Roniker Crovis during the 2378 debate over repeal of UG General Decree 2288-1257. Joined Wedge Defense Force, 2384. Current grade 05, Captain. Commanding Officer, WDF Shen Chi, Ikazuchi Class, CVS 219. Current assignment, Combined Fleet Exercise with Korean Navy, Korean Union, Kresge Sector. WDF Shen Chi, Korean Union Patrol Sector 182. Captain Ashley Williams was known to her crew as a classic space officer in the Grand Seleucian tradition. Such well-worn but accurate phrases as tough but fair and uncompromising cropped up frequently in discussions involving her. Most would probably have been shocked to see their well-traveled, seen-it-all captain getting misty-eyed at the sight of two visitors on an irregular mission that didn't even technically involve the Wedge Defense Force. But misty-eyed she was, as Virginia Shepherd and Kaden Olenko materialized in the Shanxi's main transporter room. No one from her crew was there to see it, though. Only a dark-haired, goateed man in civilian business clothes, who beamed slightly at the sight and earned himself a sardonic glance before Williams stepped forward to greet her guests. "Commander Shepherd," she said, fighting hard to keep the emotion out of her voice as she came to attention and saluted. "Captain Williams," Shepherd replied, returning the salute. "Permission to come aboard?" "Granted, ma'am," said Ash. Shepherd held the salute for a half-second longer, snapped it off with the sort of brisk precision she'd almost never indulged in as an active-duty WDF officer herself, and then came down off the transporter platform to embrace her old shipmate. "You're really back," Ash murmured. "When Morden sent up the flashgram from Griffin, I almost didn't believe it." "I'm getting that a lot lately," Shepherd said sheepishly. Williams turned her loose, turned to Caden, and said his name, hugging him even more fiercely. "Ash," Caden replied. "Good to see you." She released him and stepped back a little, giving him a mock, angry look. "That's it? Good to see you?" she said. "Don't assume this is any less weird from my end," Caden told her, grinning. "But if you insist, I'll upgrade it to damn good." "That's better," said Ash. "So, what, you're an officer now?" Shepherd asked. "I thought you worked for a living." Ash smirked. "That was a long time ago, Skipper. This is like retirement." She turned and gestured to the man in the suit, who'd stood with a patient smile while they had their reunion. "Meanwhile, you guys are so important, you've got people coming from all over the galaxy to meet you." "Tony Stark," said the man, extending the hand that wasn't holding his gleaming red metal briefcase to shake Shepherd's. "I've heard a lot about you, Commander, and I have to say I'm a big, big fan." Shepherd eyed him. "I haven't done anything yet," she said. "Well, not this time," Stark allowed, "but in your other life? Some outstanding work there." "Griff's filled me in," he explained. "I do some special contracting work for him. Covert stuff, very high-end. Like you," he added with a twinkle in his eye. Shepherd looked puzzled. "How'd you get out here ahead of us? We had to go through 4 layers of Quarian naval security to reach this area." "Mr. Stark apparently has access to some very advanced transporter technology," said Ash dryly. which I only use to visit my very favored people, Captain Williams. Stark protested with a winning smile. Ash replied. I'm sure Mrs. Stark finds that comforting. Stark shook his head resignedly. Tough room, he said. Anyway, Commander Shepard, I brought you some toys from my workshop in New Avalon. If you'll meet me in the captain's conference room on A deck when you've finished your other business aboard, I'll show you what I've got for you. Intrigued, Shepard smiled and said, I'll do that. Ladies, said Stark. Then, with a nod for Caden as well, he turned and left the transporter room. Interesting guy, Caden observed when he'd gone. Ash sighed. Tony Stark is a chaotic, grabastic pain in the neck, she said. Then aloud, but he does damn good work. Wait till you see what he's got for you, Skipper. I was tempted to knock him out and keep it for myself, she added with a grin. You don't have to call me that anymore, Ash, Shepard pointed out. Not only am I not in the WDF anymore, you'd outrank me if I was. Ash's grin became more of a wry smile. I think you'll always be Skipper to me, she said. Anyway, tell me more about this mission you're on. All Griff was able to put into the flashgram was that it's important and top secret. Shepard explained, with occasional interjections from Caden, about the Eden Prime mission and where its revelations had led them. When they'd finished, Ash whistled thoughtfully. Heavy stuff, she said, especially with the Earth Dome situation being what it is now. That's going to be a real bitch to keep on the down low, especially if it turns into a real shooting war. Shepard rolled her eyes. Tell me about it, she said. Williams thought about it for a few seconds, then said, Well, look, obviously I can't come with you. The Shang-Chi is way too obvious for the kind of work you guys are going to be doing. But I'll tell you what, I've got a few things on board that I can spare for a while, things that may help you out. For starters, she added with an enigmatic smile, I'm going to lend you my exec. He's a pain in the ass too, but he also does good work, and I think you'll find him very helpful. Raising her voice slightly, she addressed the room in general and said, Edie, where's the XO? Jeff is on the recreation deck, Captain. A faintly synthetic woman's voice replied from nowhere in particular. Ash nodded. Great. Okay. You know where that is on an Ikazuchi? I used to, Shepard replied. Well, we haven't moved it, Ash told her. Head down there and round him up. You'll know him when you see him. Back on the Surprise, Greg Adams, having learned that the ship's Quarian guest was a budding starship engineer herself, currently detached from the academy ship she attended for a 3-month practicum in the engine room of the Shang-Chi, was showing her around his own domain. Though very young, she impressed him immediately with her technical knowledge, particularly when she looked at the wildly non-standard contraption wedged into where later model Predators like the Surprise normally had a warp drive core and said, Is that the wave motion engine? Adams grinned. It sure is. Keela, Tally mused. I can't believe you got something like that into a ship this size. Wasn't easy, Adams agreed, indicating the places where he and his crew had had to cut back bulkheads and even, in a couple of places, integrate parts of the engine into the structural supports of the compartment. We had to pull the warp core, he went on, but these ships were designed before warp drive anyway, so I think that actually improved performance. They ducked under one of the main energy conduits running athwart ships and crouch-walked forward alongside the gently thrumming engine core. At the front end, Adams indicated the massive shaft that went straight out of the engine and through the forward bulkhead. And because we needed a direct run from the engine core to what used to be the torpedo bay, we had to lose the active cloak, he explained. Luckily, when we took out the secondary warp equipment up on decks 1 and 2, that left a space we were able to get an IES bank into, and Shepard's more familiar with operations using that system anyway. He led the way aft again, patted the transverse conduit with satisfaction, and continued, Use the rest of the mass allowance to bulk up the turbo laser feeds and uprate the original hyperdrive, and here we are. Amazing, said Tully. I know the IPO's Space Force is doing some pretty incredible things with their Next Generation Warships program. My grandmother is part of the design team. But this is at least a step beyond even what they're doing. Adam smiled and said modestly, Well, we're working on a much smaller scale than the NGW project. All my team had to do was take a huge budget and cram some of the best tech available into one space frame. The Defiant class, for instance, that had to be producible. The Surprise, she's one of a kind. I doubt we could even do this same conversion on another Pred without having to do most of the engineering over again from scratch. She looked around the engine room some more in silence, then said again, Amazing. I should be spending the summer with you. The Shanxi is a good ship, but I could learn more in a month in this engine room than I could in a year aboard any normal ship. Adams chuckled. Be glad to have you, he said, but given what we're going to be up to, which I'm pretty sure you're not cleared for, by the way, I doubt your tutors or your parents would thank us for taking you along. Shepard arrived on the Shanxi's rec deck to find what appeared to be a self-defense instruction session, or perhaps just a show-off sparring match, or something akin to exec pummeling day on the old Wayward Sun, in progress in the main dojo. The combatants, watched by a cheering crowd of junior officers and enlisted ratings, were a big, brawny-looking man with an elaborate neck tattoo and, Shepard thought at first glance, a synthetic of some kind. The second fighter was humanoid and no bigger than his beefy opponent. His body wasn't overtly mechanical, like the robo-cyborgs of Shepard's youth, but his limbs were obviously some kind of myomer or fiberform biosteel, like the bigger Boomer models. His whole body was covered in some kind of plasticized composite that was probably a form of flex armor, apart from his head, which was plated in a dull silver metal instead. Instead of a humanoid face, he sported a cluster of four small, glowing green optics grouped around a large central, well, she wasn't really sure what it was, speaker grill, maybe? Air intake? With a pair of rabbit ear sensor extenders mounted on articulated universal joints at the back of his head. Easing her way to the front of the crowd, she asked a young woman with senior chief's stripes, Excuse me, where's the XO? The senior chief pointed with her chin. Right there, sparring with Lieutenant Vega, she said, not looking away from the fight. Which one's Vega? Shepard wondered. With the tattoos, the chief said. Hmm, thought Shepard. Guess I might as well watch the show, then. It was quite a show to watch. Shepard didn't know how long they had been going at it when she arrived, but they kept going hammer and tongs for nearly 5 minutes after she got there. The beefcake with the neck tattoo obviously knew what he was doing and had power to spare, but his cyborg opponent was quicker, his body, though substantial, built more for finesse than brute strength. Both of them had excellent technique, and their strength pretty well balanced their weaknesses. Ultimately, though, the cyborg's greater agility and sheer sturdiness won out. The bout ended with Vega sprawled on his back and the cyborg's fist having stopped a millimeter or so from mashing his nose. Then he opened his hand, clasped Vega's, and hauled him back to his feet without apparent effort. You're getting better, Esse, Vega remarked. Yeah, right, the cyborg replied, and Shepard felt the tiny hairs on the back of her neck stand on end at the sound of his voice. It couldn't be. Then he caught sight of her out of the corner of one of his optics, turned, his sensor ears straightening upward in an unmistakable gesture of surprise, and blurted, Commander! Shepard stared at him for a second longer, only finding her voice when he crossed the space to her in two great bounds and grabbed her up in a bear hug that lifted her clean off the floor. Joker? Jack sloped into the Surprise's cargo hold, shut the bulkhead behind her, and stood, hands in her pockets, regarding the cryotube from O3F8 with a thoughtful air. She was no exoanatomist, but she'd seen a lot of Krogan in her time, and she believed what the crazy old warlord had said on the recording about his creation being perfect. The Krogan in the tank looked to be in their equivalent of his late teens. He was heavily muscled, even by Krogan standards, but not to an extent where he'd have a hard time getting out of his own way, like some of the roided-up dipshit he-men she'd encountered in her travels. His scales were small and regular, an even yellowish-pink, and the gray bone plates on his head hadn't fully fused into a mature Krogan's single glacis. Even in the tank, he was wearing heavy armor, fully prepped and ready to go, and she couldn't help but notice that O'Kear had popped for considerably higher quality equipment than his rejects had received before being turned loose on the Blue Suns. "Well, big guy," she said casually to the tank, "I don't see any reason to leave your Super Krogan ass on ice while the commander does her shopping, do you? Either you're going to help us, in which case, awesome, or you're a problem, in which case, I might as well deal with you right now." And without further ado, she triggered the tank's thaw-release cycle. Like everything else to do with this part of O'Kear's project, it was the very latest, highest quality model, and it took mere seconds to defrost and revive its cargo. With a puff of cool vapor and, weirdly, a faint scent of cotton candy, the front panel swung open and the steaming, dripping Krogan toppled out to land on hands and knees in front of her. For a few seconds he coughed and retched, clearing his four lungs of residual suspension fluid. Then he looked up at her, blinking blearily and trying to focus. It was the only Krogan Jack had ever seen who had blue eyes. "Happy birthday, big fella," she said. The Krogan blinked a couple more times, and then, with a suddenness that took even Jack by surprise, he lunged up from the floor and bull-rushed her clean off her feet. "Hoof!" Jack grunted, more surprised than hurt, as the Krogan rammed her against the bulkhead with all his considerable mass, pressing one of his armored forearms across her upper chest. "Before you die," he growled, thrusting his face into hers, "give me a name." Jack's response was to narrow her eyes at him and utter three short, percussive words that were definitely not a name. "Fus Roda!" The Krogan roared in consternation as nothing he could see or quantify plowed into him like a speeding truck, sending him hurtling back through his tube and smashing it to pieces. He carried on flying with enough remaining force to dent the far bulkhead, then rebounded and fell onto his face again, knocked momentarily senseless. Jack walked calmly around the wreckage of the tube, biotic power rippling the air around her, and stood waiting for him to regain consciousness. This took only a second or two, but the blow seemed to have taken the fight out of him, at least for the moment. He dragged himself to hands and knees, then upright, regarding her for a few seconds with a faintly impressed expression. Then, to her mild surprise, he cracked a small smile and said, "I don't like it. Too many syllables." "Well, you'll probably like my actual name better, then. I'm Jack." The Krogan shook his head. "Not your name," he said. "Mine." Jack blinked. "Oh. I don't know. Kind of figured the tank would have taken care of that." "No. The tank... there was input, there was instruction, and a lot of O'Kear's political ranting, but it didn't connect any of it. I don't care about any of it. And no name." He looked thoughtful. "Just O'Kear's words. Victory. Legacy. Foot soldier of tomorrow. Grunt. Grunt. That's not bad. It's short. Has no meaning." He shrugged. "It'll do." Jack raised an eyebrow. Well, okay. It's a free galaxy. That's what you want to be called. That's what we'll call you." "Who's we? And what makes you think I care what you call me?" She smirked slightly. You, my Krogan friend, are in luck. You just happen to have been awakened on the ship of the one and only Commander Virginia Shepherd, who, if Okir had any clue at all about anything that didn't happen on Tuchanka, you've probably heard of. Grunt's face did the Krogan equivalent of a thoughtful frown. Shepherd. Human female. Old-time WDF Special Forces. He looked puzzled. Dead since 2288. Jack nodded. And not dead since sometime last week. She put a hand on Grunt's shoulder and started steering him toward the door. Now it's up to you, big guy, she went on casually. But would you rather waste your time pushing some old psycho's agenda that you don't even buy into yourself? Or fight for a woman so badass that she got bored in friggin' warrior heaven and came back to the mortal world to headbutt some more bad guys? Grunt chuckled. Works for me. Of course, he added with perfect earnestness, if it turns out your battlemaster's chosen weak enemies, I'll have to kill you all. Jack laughed and keyed the door open. No worries on that score, trust me, she said. You're going to love being part of this posse. I don't know that word. Like a crant, only with taco night. Moreau, Jeffrey, Joker. Honors graduate, WDF Academy, Zeta Cygni II. PhD, Cosmonautics, Moscow Institute of Physics and Technology. Founder, WDF Institute for Advanced Flight Dynamics. Key publications: Integration of Line of Sight and Subspace Navigational Information in the Manual and Semi-Manual FTL Flight Regime, with K-Zora Nar Irvola, Spaceflight Journal, 2286. Exploitation of Spacetime Curvature Effects in Relativistic Drive Modes to Enhance Starship Maneuver Capabilities, Journal of the Royal Seleucian Astronautical Society, 2394. Fully Balanced Cyborg Conversion Subject. WDF Commission Reactivated, 2382. Current Grade, 04, Commander. Executive Officer, WDF Shanxi, Ikazuchi Class, CVS 219. Current Assignment, Combined Fleet Exercise with Quarian Navy, Quarian Union, Kresge Sector. Sitting at a corner table in the Shanxi's Officer's Lounge, Shepherd sipped her coffee. And how long, she wondered, had it been since she'd had proper WDF coffee? And shook her head with fond disbelief. I can't believe it's you, Joker, she said. Look who's talking, Joker replied. I saw you get spaced. Yeah, that sucked, Shepherd agreed. No pun intended. How about you? How'd this happen? Oh, it's the usual story. 30-foot fall, 163 broken bones, crazy-ass experimental cyborg process. He took a drink of his own coffee, apparently there was still enough meat inside there to deal with that, and went on, I've thought about going back to a regular body via biosculpt, especially after they finally cured Vrolix in 72, but are you kidding me? He held up both hands, palms up in a look-at-me gesture. This is awesome! They tell me only one patient in 1,000 fully adapts to the Hecatonchiri's conversion, which is why there's only like 3 of us. He shook his head. I guess the other 999 weren't as done with their original bodies as I was. Shepherd leaned forward, elbows on the table, and regarded him closely. So tell me about this cyborg system. For starters, why does it say Geiges H on your head? That's this body's chip name, Joker said. I know, crazy, right? There are so few of them, they have their own names instead of serial numbers. Geiges Hecatonchiris, Shepherd mused. One of the 100-handed giants. Somebody had a fondness for Greek myth. It's metaphorical, Joker said. The H-class body's party trick is a cybernetic command bus that can control up to 100 external systems at once. Ah, said Shepherd, nodding. That explains all the eyes. Joker nodded. Yep, I can see in all directions at once. He tilted one of his sensor booms down, Its end cap flipped open, exposing still another green optic. And around corners, it's pretty sweet. And also why so few people can adapt to this system, I expect, Shepard said. Right. Most people just can't make it work. I don't mean to brag, but like I said, 1 in 1,000, that they've tried it on. System's been around more than 80 years, and there have only been a handful of successful implementations. Somehow, Shepard wasn't sure how, she got the impression that he was giving her something like the old Joker smirk. Of course, none of the others can make it look as good as I do, he added. I don't know, Shepard teased. I kind of miss the beard. Yeah, well, me too, but you can't have everything. Joker shrugged. So what's so important it's got you back from the dead? She told him. Oh, he said. Well, that sounds serious. The boss must think so too if she's willing to loan me out. Without me around to run stuff for her, she might actually have to work a little while I'm gone. Is your ship fast? Pretty fast. I bet you could make her faster. Then sign me up. I've been driving a desk for the last 10 years. Before that, I was slinging this whale around, he said, gesturing vaguely to the ship around them. Shepard finished her coffee and got up. I hope that doesn't mean you've lost your touch, she said. Oh, you just wait, Joker replied. They went up to the captain's office, where Williams and Caden were waiting. I had a comm from the surprise while you were below, Caden reported. Seems Jack took it upon herself to wake up our Krogan. Shepard raised her eyebrows. Any casualties? Just the cargo bay wall, Ash quipped. Adams is ticked, but Tally's trying to convince him it'll buff out. Caden shook his head. Apparently they're bestest pals now, and he's going to join our fight, he said. Which is the kind of stunt you'd get away with. You've definitely rubbed off on that one. Shepard shrugged. Some girls got it, she said. Speaking of which, I better go see what Mr. Stark has for me. Ash coughed. Thank you, Captain Williams. That'll be all, Shepard added dryly as she breezed into the conference room. Tony Stark was standing at the conference table when she entered. Before she arrived, he'd hung his suit jacket on one of the chairs, rolled up his shirt sleeves, loosened his tie, and placed a large black hardshell case on the table. Now he looked up from adjusting something inside it, smiled, and lowered the lid. I heard about the Eden Prime mission, he said. Chief said your armor got pretty well scrapped. Yeah, and nearly me with it, Shepard admitted ruefully. Stark nodded. Well, I'm here to see if we can prevent that from happening again. You haven't been back long, so you probably haven't heard of me or my company. Shepard shook her head. Stark Industries makes, well, we make almost everything, but one of the things we're best known for is our line of personal protective equipment. We make industrial and tactical PPE for the International Police. Everything from rad suits and hazmat gear to the light-powered armor used by Tactical Division's Special Mission Forces. I'm also the chief designer for the Iron Man and War Machine Special Action Units, which is where you come in. He beckoned her around to his side of the table and opened the case. Within it, nestled in the obligatory custom-trimmed shock foam, was a suit of battle armor that looked not too different from her old CVR-9, apart from certain details of its articulation. It appeared to be made from intricately interlocked metal plates, rather than the composite-reinforced carbon fiber she was used to. The precise material was hard to call, because the whole thing was coated a deep and lustrous black, apart from the red and white N7 sigil on the right side of the breastplate, and its accompanying white-edged red stripe, which ran from shoulder to hand down the outside of the right arm. Until a couple of days ago, Stark explained, this was the Stage 1 prototype for the cybernetic combat vehicle Mark 10, specifically the CCV-10B, the next-generation war machine suit. When the chief called me up and told me about your mission and what you needed to make it happen, I repurposed it on the fly. Just about the rushiest rush job I ever had to do, but I'm happy with the result. Anyway, I love a challenge. Griff knows that. Shepard reached out and ran her fingertips along the ridges of the segmented abdominal plating. "Is it powered?" she asked. "Not to the extent that it would have been if I'd finished building it as war machine," Stark replied. "This is the first phase exoskeleton. It's basically capable of getting out of your way, but not much more than that. If you needed to be able to throw a car, I'd have had to get a little more time," he added with a wry grin. Shepard nodded. "That's fine. I'm not looking to leap tall buildings," she assured him. "There are a few other things it doesn't have that a fully realized CCV system would have," Stark went on. "For example, I didn't include any weapons in it because, A, I don't officially make weapons, B, I didn't have time, and C, it sounded like you had that pretty well covered anyway. Similarly, you don't have time to learn to fly, so I didn't bother completing and installing the boot jets and flight dynamic systems. It would just have been extra weight you didn't need to be carrying." Shepard glanced at him. "You make flying-powered battlesuits?" "On occasion," Stark replied. "This suit hasn't got a lot of the bells and whistles that the war machine has, but what it has got is every conceivable life support and safety system. It's got inertial compensators for sudden impacts, non-invasive automatic blood chemistry monitoring, full temperature and breathing gas regulation, hypospray pharmaceutical injectors, automatic metagel applicators, full omni-tool integration, grade 6 kinetic barriers." "Grade 6?" Shepard exclaimed. "Mm-hmm. With cyclonic oscillation reinforcement, it's capable of full NBC isolation without any modifications, and it's fully rated for 0 to 400 atmospheres external pressure." He tapped the chest plate. "It's armored with a proprietary alloy called Solaris. I won't bore you with what's in it, but it's very tough and, to a limited extent, self-repairing." He stepped back, gesturing to the suit with one hand, and concluded, "What you have here, then, is," he said modestly, "simply the most robust, self-contained protective system this galaxy has ever seen. Nothing less, and, just as importantly, nothing more. I call it the Extreme Environment Integrated Survival System. Extremis, for short." He looked her in the eye then, becoming fully serious for the first time in their short acquaintance, and said, "It'll keep you alive. The rest is up to you." Shepard regarded him for a second, then turned back to look at the suit. "Thanks," she said. "Any questions?" Stark asked. "What's omni-tool integration?" she wondered. "That just means the suit's designed to be operated with an omni-tool." Stark powered up a holographic mini-computer, its UI surrounding his left hand in sculpted orange light. "Computer, sensor package, data recorder, comm system, mini-fabricator, cybernetic intrusion device. These things can do almost anything. I wish I'd thought of it," he added with a wry grin. Then, pointing to a separate small item tucked away in another pocket of the case's internal foam, he went on, "There's one in here for you. It's got a program loaded on it with all the information you'll need to maintain and repair the Extremis suit, and of course all the software to operate the suit itself. They're easy to use. You'll get the hang of it in no time." Shepard regarded the suit for a few moments more, then reached down and picked up one of its gauntlets. It was slightly heavy, and with the suit powered down, the joints in the assembled arm resisted a little, but not as much as she'd have expected. She turned the gauntlet over in her hand, noting the full range of motion in the wrist and elbow joints, and spied a circular port in the palm of the glove. "What's this?" She gave him a sly smile. "It looks suspiciously weapon-like to me." "That's a repulsor. Directed force beam projector. It's not a weapon, it's a flight stabilizer," Stark added piously. "This suit can't fly," Shepard pointed out. "Late-night design oversight," said Stark with a wink. They emerged to find that several more people had arrived in Ash's office. The lieutenant Joker had been sparring with before, another, slimmer, darker man Shepard didn't recognize, and Tally. Stark told Shepard not to hesitate to call if she had any questions or difficulties with the system, thanked Captain Williams for her hospitality, and then, with the kind of grin that said he really enjoyed moments like this, disappeared in a wash of light that was similar but not identical to a transporter beam. "Show off," Ash grumbled. "The man thinks big, I have to give him that," Shepard said, glancing down at the case, much lighter than it looked like it ought to be, she'd carried out of the conference room. "If this suit does even half the things he says it will, today is officially the best Christmas ever, even though it's August." "Oh, it'll do everything he said," Williams assured her. "Like I said before, he's a pain, but he knows what he's doing." Shepard nodded, but before she could reply verbally, the office door opened and another person entered. A human woman, silver-haired, but of that peculiarly ageless sort of middle age some women seem to arrive at without really trying. She was dressed not in a WDF uniform, but rather the field togs of the Republic of Zeta Cygni Medical Service, the organization that operated Zeta Cygni's public hospitals. And she carried a slab-sided white doctor's kit marked with the International Blue Star of Life. Just inside the door, this person started to say, "You called for me, Captain?" in a voice with the calm, cultured sound of the Vega sector about it, but she only got as far as called before she caught sight of Shepard and stopped short, both verbally and physically. Shepard grinned, recognizing her immediately. "Dr. Chakwas, I presume," she failed to resist saying. A less sturdy medical type might have dropped her kit bag at the sight of such an apparition, but Karen Chakwas, M.D., was not that kind of doctor. She took only a second to process what she was seeing, then smiled calmly and remarked, "Commander Shepard, how spectacularly good to see you again. I look forward to hearing how you manage this at some point when we've more time." Her smile became slightly wryer as she added, "However, based on prior history, one expects life is now about to become rather hectic." Shepard looked faintly rueful. "That's probably a pretty safe bet," she admitted. "I'm sending Joker to help the commander out with her current mission," Williams explained. "And you know I'd never sign up for a suicide mission without you," Joker added cheerfully. Indicating his more obvious bionics, he added, "You're the only one who knows how any of this stuff actually works." Chakwas chuckled indulgently. "I wouldn't miss it." Looking past him to the two men Shepard hadn't met, the doctor added dryly, "And I see you're bringing along the rest of your support staff as well." "Well, yeah, I mean, man of my importance got to have his entourage," Joker agreed. "Commander, these are Miss Vatos, James, and Steve," he added expansively, gesturing first to Lieutenant Vega, then the other man. "They're here to make sure the extremely expensive hardware doesn't get broken, something that Captain Williams is acutely aware tends to happen a lot around you." Shepard laughed and shook first one man's hand, then the other. "Jin Shepard, nice to meet you. Did you ask for this job, or did you get voluntold?" "James Vega," said the beefy man with the tattoos. "Voluntold, but I don't mind. Hell, it's an honor to work with somebody I used to read about in school." "Ouch," said Shepard. "You know how to make a girl feel her age, Mr. Vega. And you are?" she asked the second man. "Lieutenant Steve Cortez, ma'am," he replied. "It's a pleasure." "And this," Joker went on, holding up one of his hands, "is Edie." A holojector in his palm rezzed up the 3D image of a tiny, perfectly formed woman who seemed to be made of light and scrolling text. Shepard recognized the effect as the trademarked icon style of a Seleucian Halos starship machine intelligence construct. "Greetings, Commander," said the MI in a calm, faintly flanged voice. "I am the Enhanced Defense Intelligence currently assigned to the Shenqi, Senior Lieutenant EDI 219. My Turing name is Edie Moreau. I will be assisting Jeff in your mission. He's quite helpless without me." She paused for a half beat, then continued in exactly the same deadpan tone. "That was a joke." Shepard chuckled. "Been a long time since I worked with a Turing-rated MI. Glad to have you aboard. I hope my ship is equipped to make use of your capabilities.
Have no fear on that account, Commander, Edie replied. The surprise has been optimized for both of us. Mr. Adams has seen to that.
Oh, has he? Said Shepard with an arch smile, filing that factoid away to be dealt with later. Speaking of computer stuff, is your gear squared away, Tally?
Tally nodded. Already set up aboard the Surprise. It didn't take long. The equipment's all modular.
Equipment? Shepard wondered.
Yes. Something I think you'll find helpful for your mission. I'll show you how it works while you run me back to Halo.
Which you should probably be doing any time now, Ash put in. Warden must be just about done packing, and I know you. You'll be wanting to get on to the next phase as fast as you can.
She came around her desk and saluted Shepard again.
Clear skies, Commander.
Thank you, Captain, Shepard replied, returning the salute.
Another hug for her, one for Caden, and the party filed out, bound for the transporter room. Shepard was the last to leave, and as she approached the door, Ash called her back.
Before you go, there's one more thing, she said. If you get into real trouble out there, the kind of trouble you need a really, really big gun to get out of, you holler. We've got full drive. We'll be there.
Are you sure? Shepard asked.
I appreciate the thought, Ash. I really do. But you could be stepping in a whole pile of shit if you jump into the middle of this thing.
Ash smiled her sarcastic little smile. Did you forget? Stepping in piles of shit's the Williams way, she said. Then, becoming serious again, she repeated, We'll be there.
Shepard looked into her eyes for a second, then nodded.
I'll remember that, she said.
Thanks, Ash.
You take care of yourself out there, Skipper, Williams told her. When this thing is over, we've got a lot of drinking to do. With the Surprise back on course for the inner Scandia system and the Quarian Navy's aerospace traffic controllers happy with their flight plan, Shepard left the bridge and went with Tally Zora to one of the tiny ancillary workshops off the engine room. In the space of the 90 minutes or so she'd spent on the Shanxi, this had been converted into what looked like a computer center, crammed with several racks of technical equipment and a large central holoconsole. Tally powered this up, using, Shepard noticed, an omni-tool, and explained,
Earlier this year, I started hearing from some of my contacts out in the wider galaxy about the strange things going on coreward of Earth. Morden hasn't told me, but I assume that's what your ultra-secret important mission with the mysterious paralyzing robot bugs is about, she added wryly.
That'd be a reasonably safe bet, Shepard allowed, impressed. Well, as it happens, I already had this system in place by the time any of that came up, Tally said. Basically, it's an experiment in distributed subspace radio interferometry. I have a network of 52 stations scattered around known space, mostly in the Federation, but a few in Klingon space and out on the far rim. We call ourselves the International Techno Union. Started out as an online lark. Shared interests, tech nerd stuff, you know how it goes. But this thing piqued our interest, so we got seriously to work on it in April. She gestured to the display windows, all of which showed waveforms or subspace curvature plots of one kind or another. Shepard was rusty on her FTL radiometry and couldn't read any specific graph off the top of her head, but it all looked familiar. She nodded to show that she understood at least that much. We're using home-built subspace radio telescopes to monitor and track unexplained signals, Tally explained. Over the last few months, we've compiled a pretty detailed signature of the anomaly. That's what we call it. Its appearances all correlate reasonably closely with the rumored EA colony depopulations in the Traverse.
How reasonably? Shepard wondered.
Tally opened a few data windows in the holodisplay, then turned and made ghostly eye contact with Shepard through her visor, before replying,
I assume that the specimen Morden and I have been working with came from the most recent colony attack?
Shepard nodded. "You've pieced enough of it together that I don't mind telling you the rest," she said. "The EA's colonies are being abducted en masse by an alien race called the Collectors. Those bug things are how they immobilize their victims for, well, collection. I recovered that one during their attack on Eden Prime last week."
"Can you tell me the exact date and time?"
Shepard took out her datapad and consulted the mission report, then read off the figures she'd put down for the approximate start and exact end of the incident. Tally plugged this data into one of the programs running on her console, then nodded, turned to her, and reported with grim satisfaction,
"Our last hit coincides with your report of the attack on Eden Prime exactly. Start time, duration, everything. My current hypothesis is that whatever the Collectors are using to black out the comms when they hit these colonies causes a subspace disturbance. It's not much, but I've effectively got 52 antennae pointed at the traverse, and after a lot of trial and error, we know exactly what to look for."
She shook her head.
"Correlation doesn't necessarily imply causation, but in this case I'd say the probabilities are pretty damn good."
Shepard gave her an admiring look.
"This is good work," she said. "How old are you?"
14, Tally replied.
Before Shepard could respond to that, if she'd been planning to, the compartment suddenly filled with an unfamiliar but unmistakable alert sound, and red light from a flashing notification icon in the holo console's display field. Startled, Tally turned, then nearly lunged for the console, flinging open new windows and then pulling up an entire ranked grid of Vox-only comm icons.
"Anomaly detected," she declared. "All stations, check in."
"Station 2, online," a voice replied. "Station 17, online," said another, and so on until all but two had checked in.
49's in class," the voice that had identified itself as 10 reported. "It's 0930 where he lives."
"Right, and it's the middle of the night for 32, Tally acknowledged. "Good enough. Let's start narrowing it down."
She worked the console for a few moments, flicking through windows too fast for Shepard, being unfamiliar with the system, to tell what was happening. There was a constant background murmur now, as comms between the other stations relayed through Tally's console at half volume. She worked for another few moments, then tabbed one of the comm icons and said,
"Station 44, this is Control. I'm getting a contact return in grid Gamma 7. Can you confirm?"
"Roger, Control, confirmed," 44 reported. "Station 12, can you triangulate?"
After a moment's pause and a few more fluttering windows, 12 answered,
"It's an intermittent trace, but..."
"Okay, got 'em. Looks like they're somewhere in the Argos Row cluster. I can't resolve it any better than that without at least one more beam."
"Understood," Tally replied crisply. "Station 20, you're in Argos Row. Can you narrow that down?"
"Yes, I can," 20's voice replied matter-of-factly.
"They're here."
The background chatter and the flow of windows abruptly halted as everyone on the circuit took that on board.
"Say again?" Tally asked.
"They're here," 20 repeated. Her, Shepard thought it sounded like a young woman anyway, voice almost preternaturally calm.
"On Paragon, right now. I have to go. It's only a matter of time before they detect my HW emissions."
The calm voice cut off in a squeal of subspace static, and the icon for Station 20 went dark. Tally stabbed at it anyway, getting no response, and said,
"20, are you still online? Do you copy? Jen!"
"Control, this is 28, came another voice. "Confirmed, Paragon just dropped off the net. All channels black, just like usual."
"Damn," Tally spat. "All stations, keep monitoring. 14, you have control. I'm going to be on the move on this end."
If Station 14 were dismayed at being handed the reins of the operation, his... voice gave no sign of it as he replied calmly,
"Roger, Station 1. 14 has the token."
"Page me if anything changes," Tally told them.
Station 1, out. Then, after shutting down the comm board, she turned to Shepard and said,
You heard. They're hitting Paragon right now. We have to get moving.
Shepard was already leaving the workshop. If by we you mean you guys, she allowed, I'm not charging into combat with a miner on board. We'll have to drop you.
The hell with that!
Tally barked, grabbing Shepard's shoulder and all but spinning her around. All the people in the ITU are my friends, but 20 is special. We've known each other since long before this began. She's the one who suggested the anomaly tracking network experiment in the first place. I'm not leaving her to face these collectors alone. Shepard scowled at her.
Kid, I just told you, she said. You're smart, and I have no doubt that your heart's in this, but you're 14. Your government and your parents would have my head if I took you into the EA, much less into combat there, and rightly so.
My mother is dead, and my father doesn't give a damn what happens to me, Tally said bluntly. I'm qualified in small arms, my biosuit is fully equipped for hazardous environments, and I am going. And you are just wasting time trying to stop me, she added, folding her arms pugnaciously.
Shepard regarded her for a couple of seconds, then sighed, turned, and resumed her course.
You're right about one thing, I don't have time for this. At the top of the forward engine room stairs, she punched the call key on the nearest intercom panel and said, Joker, you up for a little crazy time?
I'm on that like blue on milk, Joker replied.
Then plot me a space fold from Halo to the Paragon system and get me to the jump point the fastest way you know how. If you're feeling really ambitious, figure out a way to pick up Morden along the way without stopping.
Any doubts I might possibly have entertained about you being the real Virginia Shepard are now gone, Joker replied with enormous audible satisfaction. It shall be done.
Good. I'll be there in a minute. Someone calm Morden and let him know this is no longer a research project. Shepard out.
She clicked off, then turned to Tally and drew breath to tell her once more that under absolutely no conceivable circumstances was she to even consider the possibility that she might be allowed to ride into battle with Shepard's privateers. Tally wasn't in a position to listen, however, as she had her omni-tool powered up and her other hand against the side of her helmet in the universal unconscious on-the-com gesture. Before Shepard could ask her what she was doing, Tally did something with her omni-tool that activated Shepard's, and a small holographic representation of a Quarian man's head and shoulders appeared above the back of her hand.
Commander Shepard, this is Colonel Vedek Zorovas Archangel speaking, he said. I believe you are acquainted with my grandfather Keverin.
Shepard blinked.
That's correct, Colonel, she said.
Then you'll have no trouble interpreting my words when I say that my granddaughter Tally is very much cut from the same bolt of cloth, said Vedek. For various legal reasons, I can't explicitly give you permission to take her into harm's way. She isn't qualified to begin her pilgrimage yet. What I can do is tell you that, as a member of the Quarian Naval Reserve and a fellow of the Advanced Astronautics Program of the Academy ship Hecatemos, she's already on detached duty completing an engineering practicum aboard a Wedge Defense Force warship. And they, in turn, are perfectly within their rights to assign her to your vessel for a period of time. Should some unforeseen combat situation happen to arise during that time, well...
He shrugged eloquently.
That's the spacer's life.
Thank you, Grandfather, said Tally.
The hologram of Vedek on Shepard's wrist turned to face Tally.
Look out for yourself, Tally Zora, he told her. Do what you must.
Kila Selai.
Kila Selai, Tally responded.
Vedek's image turned and addressed Shepard again.
Good hunting, Commander. Zora out.
Shepard regarded her hand with bemusement for a moment, then looked at Tally.
That's some grandfather you've got there, she remarked.
He's the best, Tally agreed. Are we good?
I have a choice now, Shepard replied with a sardonic grin.
She resumed her course for the bridge. It's going to be hard for Ash to explain if this really turns out to be a suicide mission.
Then don't get me killed, said Tally.
Shepard paused at the entrance to the neck corridor, glanced back, and grinned. You're a firecracker, kid. Then, shaking her head resignedly, she started walking once more and added, This has got to be contributing to the delinquency of a minor or child endangerment or something.
Technically, I think it's kidnapping, but only if we get caught.
Shepard took the center seat and saw that Joker was fully engaged at the helm, working some of the holo controls with his hands, even though he had himself connected to the console with a couple of heavy-gauge cybernetic interface cables. She remembered what Edie had said about the ship's optimization, and assumed the console had been outfitted with the option for such high-octane cybernetic control, specifically in anticipation of him sitting there.
How many of you guys knew about this and didn't say anything? She asked Liara in her low voice.
Liara smiled slightly.
He asked us not to spoil the surprise, as it were.
For the record, I was just as much in the dark as you, Caden told her. Liara nodded, a shadow crossing her face.
It happened at Horizon, she said quietly. After... you.
Caden nodded. Ah. You guys don't have to whisper, you know, said Joker. I can hear you anyway. In fact, plugged in like this, I could hear you pretty much anywhere in the ship.
And whatever he missed, Edie added, I would catch.
Jack looked up from the comic book she was reading at the comm station and observed, That's not at all creepy. Okay, got my vectors computed and locked, said Joker briskly. Edie, you ready on the transporter?
Affirmative, Edie replied. Scott equations loaded and calculated. Systems are pre-energized and locked on. Professor Solis is standing by.
Joker nodded. Then it's showtime, he said. With a click, his voice emerged from the PA speakers on the bridge and throughout the hull, without, Shepard noticed, issuing from his body this time. Ladies and gentlemen, this is your first officer speaking. The captain has illuminated the no smoking sign. As he said this, the ship's internal lighting switched from normal white to caution amber. Please fasten your seat belts and return your seat backs and tray tables to the upright and locked position. Complicated hyperspace vector calculations scrolled across the main viewer too fast for anyone on the bridge to get more than the vaguest impression of them, and then, to Shepard's shock and faint dismay, their surprise went to light speed. She stifled the impulse to ask Joker what the hell he was doing. He was, after all, Joker. This was what he did. It had been what he did before he was fitted with the most sophisticated cybernetic command and control interface in the galaxy. She had to trust that he'd only gotten better at it with such tools at his command. And so, to show that trust, she made herself sit back in her con, glance grinning at Liara like she didn't have a care in the world, and let him get on with it. The surprise boomed out of hyperspace again mere seconds later, having jumped most of the way across the Scandia system on a precisely calculated hyperbolic arc that avoided the mass shadows of the flotilla like a race car darting through the back markers, a maneuver very few helmsmen would have attempted, and even fewer could have pulled off. Joker and Edie had calculated it so finely, in fact, that they were still surfing the small space warp created by exiting hyperspace, still doing a significant fraction of light speed, in other words, when the ship belted straight through the middle of the ring of halo. Jack glanced to her left, where the communications panel was alight with Scandia ATC's fury about what they'd just done. With a shrug, she switched the panel off and went back to her comic book. At the back of the bridge, Arna glanced wide-eyed at James Vega, who just grinned at her.
Transport complete, Edie reported, her voice as calm as always. Then she added blandly, Try not to hit the gas giant.
Yeah, yeah, Joker replied distractedly, his bionic hands flying over the helm holo controls, while others appeared to operate themselves. The surprise half-barrel-rolled once clear of the ring, skating through the very uppermost layers of substance's atmosphere, just enough to cause the friction warning light to flick on and then off again on the bridge engineer's panel where Tally sat, and then a different set of engines spooled up audibly within the space frame. The amber interior lighting flicked to red as Edie reported, "Gravitic hazard zone cleared. Wave motion space fold in 5, 4, 3, 2. The surprise's exhausts flared blue hot. Space-time itself bent, and they were gone. This concludes Undocumented Features Future Imperfect, Shepherd's 11, Act 2, Shepherd's Privateers. To be continued in Act 3, Renegades of Paragon.